Welcome to the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. Show notes, links, and contact details can be found at robnunphoto.com. That's www.robnunphoto.com. SCL is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network, and loads of other great tech podcasts can be found over at www.techpodcast.com. Now on with the show. Hi everybody, and welcome to SCL, the Subject Composition and Light Photography Podcast. It's the 14th of April 2013, and this is episode 218, believe it or not. And I think I've actually done three episodes in a row over 3 weeks, haven't I? Gosh, I'm being too consistent. That's because basically I was on holiday for a week, went back to work for a week, and I've been on holiday for a week again. The first week was just usually getting some holiday. This one was to be off while Oliver was on school holidays, but luckily Suzanne was off as well. So I've had a bit more time on my hands to do various things. So today, what I thought I'd talk about is what I've been up to over the last week or so, and a little bit about depth of field as well, because I've had some interesting questions about depth of field, and I've done a video on YouTube as well. So I thought it might be something interesting to revisit. Obviously, if you're totally au fait with depth of field, then by all means, when we get to that bit, just turn off. But maybe there might be the odd thing that you learn, or you might listen to me and think, actually, Rob, you've forgotten something, and send me an email about it. scalespeed@gmail.com. Right, so what I've been up to, well, this week, I decided, right, I'm going to go out on a night shoot to finally kick my bottom into gear about practicing with coloured gels, coloured filters on my flashes. And I've been spending far too much time looking at eBay and second-hand camera websites, looking at different types of cameras, you know, because I'm still thinking, do I get a 550D second-hand? Do I get a 600D new body, because they're about £400 on eBay, £400 on Amazon? Do I go full frame and buy a second-hand 5D Mark I body for about £400, £450? Or do I even go for something like the 1D Mark II Model N, which is really old? It's only 8 megapixels, but it's one of the pro sort of Canon cameras that can shoot at, like, I think it has almost 9 frames a second. So, you know, I've got, you know when it is, when you get into that mindset of buying, you think, oh, you're going to buy something. I mean, to be honest, I haven't got any money anyway, so it's not like I can. But you kind of get sucked into the cycle of every day, saying, oh, I better check eBay, see if there's anything on there. So anyway, to get me out of doing that, I thought, right, I've got to go out on a night shoot. When I say night, it was more of a dusk shoot, with the idea of going around to Fort Brockhurst. I went down to Leon Solent first, but anyway, going out with my flashes and illuminating something with my flashes, and putting a coloured filter on the front of my flashes to give it a funny colour and to see what happened. You know, kind of inspired by, I can't remember the name of his guy, but there's lots of people actually do it on the internet, well, all over the world, where you do painting with light, and not necessarily using flashes, but the classic ones tend to be like in America, in a plain graveyard, and they'll go around and pop coloured flashes at different points. So they use a long exposure and just run around and pop lots of different coloured flashes to light everything up, lots of different colours. I didn't want to do exactly that. I didn't want to be doing a long exposure and doing stuff. I wanted to be doing one exposure, a 200th of a second, for example, and then just firing one or two flashes with coloured filters on to do it. So I got my kit together, got my 350D, got my, I think I took the YN565 Yongnuo flash and one of the others, can't remember which one it was, got my Strobis Roscoe gels with the addition of the little bits of sellotape on the end so I could sellotape them to the front of the flashes, and my wireless triggers, and promptly went out. Went down to Leon Solin to go down to the beach, because it was also, there was also a chance of a sunset, but getting down there, you know, the sun went behind these huge clouds, and that was it. No chance of a half-decent sunset at all. So I thought, well, I might as well have a little bit of a play with the flashes, so I fired them off just to get used to the system. Again, and using it outside, because I've used the wireless flash system, the system I've got quite a few times inside, but not really outside, and they were just playing around and trying to light up these, what's left of what's called these groins. And a groin is basically like a sea break almost. But imagine you're on a beach, and there's fences that are going out perpendicular, right angles to the beach, into the sea. And what they do is they stop all the stones or the sand from migrating too far along the beach. It kind of keeps the beach all together. It's a form of sea defence. And they're called a groin. But they don't really get maintained that much anymore in the UK. And so there's just these posts sticking out. So I was trying to light them up with that. Not very successfully, because they weren't pretty big. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I thought, right, let's head on down to... that there's some more fortifications round by Stokes Bay, but I got there and I thought, well, they're not very big, to be honest. I thought, no, let's cut to the chase, let's go straight to Fort Brockhurst, the local fort that's right next to where I live. And, you know, in my mind's eye, I could see the main gate on the bridge and firing some strobes at it. So I got down there, and it was still light, but I knew if I was shooting at ISO 100, you know, at 200th of a second, the ambient light would be very low, you know, it would be almost dark. And if I tightened up the aperture to sort of F8, it did go dark as well. I was shooting in manual mode. And then I just set up my one of my strobes on the little stand in front of the door, about 10 feet back, aimed it at the door, and popped off the flash with the red filter on it. And it was really good. Now, you could say, well, you might as well go... just taken a normal picture, even with a flash maybe, and you could have added some colour at home. And that's true. When you're doing anything lighting with strobes or flashes with coloured gels, you can do lots of this stuff at home in post-processing. But what you can't always reproduce is that randomness of playing around with colours and mucking around with the white balance on your camera as well to produce these different effects, with the ambient light as well that's hanging around. But also, when you mix colours, that can be where things get very interesting. Now, I didn't really get a chance to do much of that, which I'll explain in a minute, but if you can imagine, if you've got, say, two flashes, one's red and one's green, if you were just doing one flash, then yeah, you could apply a coloured filter in Photoshop and apply a red filter, or anything really to give the photo a red a hue. But if you have another flash that fires off as well, so you're mixing different colours, that random effect that you can get can be very unusual, and especially when you combine that with your white balance. So if you can imagine you had something like a tungsten white balance on your camera, and then so basically your camera's getting rid of orange, but then you had something like a yellow filter firing and a red filter firing, where those colours sort of kind of combined, and you would get orange, those bits would appear to be normal, and then the other bits would be different colours. There's all sorts of random-ish effects that you can introduce, so it's good fun to play around with. So I've got my nice red picture of the main gate at Fort Brockhurst. Then what I'll do is I'll put a couple of pictures on the in the show notes over at robnunphoto.com. And then I put a violet filter on and fired that at the secondary gate, which is just a little bit further up. But that was quite good. And with that one, I played around a bit with the white balance and the ambient light. And then I thought, right, okay, what we'll do next? I'd become quite aware that there's quite a lot of wildlife at Fort Brockhurst, and as I was popping off these flashes, I don't think they were particularly pleased. Lots of birds, and they kept flying away. I thought, no, this probably isn't the best thing to do. I don't really want to disturb the wildlife. So I went round to the other side of the moat, and there's a big tree, a big old oak tree. I thought, haha, I'll light this from below, and it might look quite creepy. So I got one of the strobes out and took some test shots. Well, took some shots, and then I got one of the other strobes out, and then that's when I found that one of the the batteries in one of the receivers was going flat, so I didn't have any range, so that was a bit of a bummer. But the real problem I had was that it was getting really dark, and I quickly found out that I couldn't see well enough to focus the camera. I mean, the autofocus wasn't working, and I couldn't see well enough to see what was going on playing around with my strobes as well. And I also became very aware that if I dropped anything, the only torch I had with me was the little torch on my phone, which isn't that bright. You know, if I dropped something, I wouldn't have much chance of finding it. And also, you know, I'm standing on a path next to a moat, and I started thinking, whoa, you know, I could fall over here. So I fired some more stuff off, but, you know, I had the big learning curve that if I'm going to do anything like that, when you're working in the dark, you need a torch. So you need, like, a head torch to help you focus the camera when you're shining at things, and also to help you actually see what you're doing. But I was pleasantly pleased as a first effort with the shots. You know, they're nice and basic, but it shows something that can be done, and the kit worked. A lot of this is just testing the kit as well and getting myself familiar with the kit. The other photo book I got out on was on yesterday, because luckily enough, kind of, Suzanne and Oliver have both joined the local gym. And they're having a great fun down there. But the problem I have, because my job, the hours are so long, I never really have enough time. You know, I have to leave for work at 7:10 in the morning, and I normally don't get home till 7:10 at night. By the time I've had some tea, I probably won't really fancy going down to the gym. And it's not really my thing, treadmills and stuff. I'd rather get on my bike. Now, I do need to lose an awful lot of weight. You know, I'm well overweight now. I weigh almost 17 stone, which is the heaviest I've ever weighed in my life. But, you know, I've been going out for walks, and I will be getting rid of that, and I'm cutting down on the junk. But what that does mean is there's a couple of hours every now and again when Suzanne and Oliver go down the gym where I can just consult my list of projects, you know, shooting locations, run off and go and do some shooting. But yesterday it was throwing it down, it was raining really hard, and I thought, oh, what am I going to do? But, you know when you got in your head, you think, I'm going to go out, I don't care if it's raining, I'm going to go out. Now, bearing in mind, I've only got a 350D, so it's not weather sealed, and my lenses aren't weather sealed and stuff like that. So I kind of went out, I thought, where am I going to go? I thought, well, I really need to go somewhere where there's woods, because I can't be out in the open when it's throwing it down, because, you know, I am going to get just soaked, and it's going to ruin my kit. But at least if I'm underneath some cover, then, you know, I've got a bit of protection. So I thought, I know, I'll go to, there's a place called, I think it's the Alva Valley Country Park. It's not really... There's a lot of MOD land around Gosport, and this is another bit where some of it's MOD land and some of it's owned by a trust or something or other. But basically it's open land, and it's quite nice. There's a wooded area, and then there's an open, like, heathland. Not very big, but big enough to walk around, and there's an artificial lake that's been made. And I'm sure it's very beautiful and nice day. When it's throwing down, it's not so, but I thought, no, I'm going to do it. And there were some interesting, like, walkways that I took pictures of. It was really damp, though, because it's in damp underfoot as well, because it's in, like, a river basin, I think you'd call it. Like, lots of it is almost like marshland. And because it's been raining almost constantly for the past 4 months in the UK, the ground is really muddy. But there's some rather cool, like, raised pathways. When I say raised, I mean, like, raised about a foot, with, like, duck boards that goes through some of the wooded areas. So, there's, you know, it's quite eerie, some interesting trees. I took my flashes along to maybe do some more of those type of illuminated shots, but to be honest, it was raining quite hard, so what I was just doing was whipping my camera out, taking a few shots, then putting it back in the bag just to keep it from getting damaged. And that kind of made me think again, going back to the new camera stuff, you know, is it worth buying something like a, instead of a 550D, get something like a 50D, or like the 5D, something that's a little bit more weather-sealed. Because I do like going out, even in bad weather, but I'd hate for it to frazzle my DSLR, you know? So that was okay. When I got home, I was very careful to lay everything out and let everything dry out my camera bag before I touched it or turned it on. But that was a nice little walk. So, you know, even if it's raining, grab your kit and go out, because you never know, there might be a break in the weather, and most of our kit can handle a little bit of moisture on it. I mean, I wouldn't want to stand out in the pouring rain with my camera, but if it's from underneath some woods, and it's just, you know, the odd droplet gets on it. It's definitely fine. Now, this week as well, I've kind of had my first go at doing more of a long form video for YouTube. To say my videos are ad hoc is an understatement. Basically, I get an idea for a video, or I've got some kit that I need to review, or a book, photo book or something like that, and I set up the camera, do a couple of checks, start recording, do it in one take, add some titles in Premiere Elements, squash it down and send it to YouTube, but that's it, you know. I very rarely do second takes because I just don't have the time and I don't plan it or anything, but I thought, no, I want to do a more in-depth video. And I got a question from Ian Miles, hi Ian, about depth of field. And what you said was that lots of Canon cameras, the more entry level ones like the 450, 550, etc., and the older film ones used to have, well, still do have a function called A depth. And I remember I used to have it on my EOS 50 E film SLR. It was a really useful feature. What you would do is you would take your camera, set it into that mode, and you'd focus on something that you wanted in the far limit of where you wanted something focused. Focus on that. Press the button, focus on the nearest thing, and then the camera would choose an aperture where all of those things in between would be in focus. How useful is that? Really good. But they don't put it on their more expensive cameras. I haven't got on my 350D either. And he was kind of saying, well, you know, how can you get around this? How do you know what's in focus or not? So what I thought I'd do is I'd do a video on depth of field. And if you go to robnanphoto.com, you'll see I'll put a link to the video on. And also, if you can't see the show notes for show 218, if you're on the right hand side of robnanphoto.com, somewhere down on the right hand side there's this thing that says my videos on YouTube. Click on that, that'll take you to all the videos on YouTube and you'll be able to find it there. So I thought, right, I'm going to do a proper video this time, which in different sections, with me actually going out and taking test shots as well. So go and have a look at it if you've got some queries about depth of field. There's probably lots of mistakes in it because, again, I'm doing it off the cuff. But it's a little bit more, it's about 20 minutes long, but it kind of, I go into explaining what depth of field is and how you can control it. So I thought, as I've done one for YouTube, I might as well talk about it in the podcast because it is something we kind of come back to every now and again, but I can't remember the last time we talked about it, so I thought I'd go for it. So, again, if you're cool with depth of field and don't need anything, any more hints and tips about it, then by all means turn the podcast off. If you want to carry on listening, then by all means do so. And if I've left something out or I've got something wrong, please email, because I'm very good at getting these things wrong because you kind of have so many assumptions. So depth of field is the amount of a photo that's acceptably sharp in terms of distance from the camera. So think about, you're standing there with your camera and there's a person, say, I don't know, 10 feet away, and you're doing like a portrait of them. And so you want, so the depth of field would be the amount of the picture in front of that person and to behind of that person that's in focus. So it could be that you want a big depth of field. Let's say they're standing in front of a beautiful vista with mountains in the distance and there's like some flowers in front of them. So you want all of that in focus. It could be that you want to concentrate attention on them, so you'd want a small depth of field, so you just want them in focus, maybe like only their eyes and everything else is nice and soft. And that's basically what depth of field is, and it's one of those artistic considerations that we should think about when we're taking photographs, because it changes the look of them. Compact cameras, because they have very small sensors and the way that the lenses are set up, normally have pretty massive depth of field on them. So it's not something you really have to think about. And having a big depth of field is a real boon, because it means normally, no matter what you do, no matter what you focus on, chances are everything's going to be in focus. You're always going to get nice shots. And one of the tricky things is when you move up to SLRs or DSLRs, is that if you focus on the wrong thing, what you want it to be in focus will probably be blurred because they're capable of producing photographs with shorter depth of field. So it is something we need to be aware of. And you also often might be in a situation where you want to focus, you want everything in a scene to be in focus. So if you want everything to be in focus, what do you focus on? and that sort of thing. So let's think about how we alter depth of field, and what are the ramifications. Now, the other thing I'd say is, whenever you're reading about depth of field or discussing depth of field or playing around with it, don't get too hung up on the actual physics of what's happening, because there's a difference between the reality of what the depth of field actually is in terms of inches or centimetres and what it appears to be. Okay, because some of the things we do, although they appear to change the depth of field, they don't. But don't worry about it. You know, if something appears to work, then go with it. If don't get too hung up on the semantics of well, actually, you know, the depth of field hasn't changed. It's just you think it has. You know, because you'll see these discussions on websites and in articles. But don't worry about that. So let's go back to the beginning. So we want to control depth of field. Now, the most basic way we do that is on our cameras, by changing the aperture. And the aperture is the size of the hole in the lens that lets the light in, that you change normally to adjust your exposure. So as you would go to aperture priority mode on your camera, and normally if you're in automatic or program, the camera's doing this automatically, you go to aperture priority mode, and if you've got a kit lens, it'll probably go from something like f3.5 to f22, and they relate to the size that this hole is. Now, it's not a definite size, you know, it's not like in millimetres, because it's actually a fraction of the focal length of how long the lens is, so it's a fraction. But don't worry about that. All you need to worry about is the fact that f3.5, right, is a bigger hole than f22, and the bigger the hole, the smaller the depth of field. So if you want a small depth of field, you choose a small number. If you want a big depth of field, you choose a big number. And that's it, really. So you would just change your depth of field. So if you wanted a very small depth of field and you were focusing on somebody, you would go to, say, f3.5. If you wanted a big depth of field and you wanted the stuff behind them in focus, you go to a larger f-stop, which is another name for aperture or f-number, and so I'll go to f16, focus on them, and whatever's behind them probably will be in focus too. And that's the simple way of thinking about it. And that's basically how you're changing the depth of field with the settings in your camera, as well as, which is kind of, it's not really a setting, but it's what your camera's doing, the focal distance, so where you're focused, what's being focused on, your focal length, which is how long your lens is, and then the other two things are how far away you are from your subject and how far away your subject is from the background. So we've talked about aperture, so if you want a shorter depth of field, use a bigger hole, use a smaller number, and then if you want a big depth of field, use a higher number. But one of the most effective ways to do it is to change how far you are away from your subject and how they're far away from the background. So if you take, for example, let's take the case of that person standing in front of a beautiful vista in the background, but we want that background to be we want that background to be in focus. One of the things we might have to do is back off a bit, because you might find that if you're standing right next to them and focusing on them, say you're sort of 4 or 5 feet away, it would be very difficult to get a massive depth of field where they're in focus and the back's in focus, unless you do something a little bit later on. So you might have to step back a few steps. However, if, say, someone's standing in front of there's a wall behind them, and you want to take a nice headshot of them, one of the simplest things to do is just make them stand further away from the wall, because then hopefully the depth of field will have dropped off by the time it gets to the wall, and the wall will be nice and blurred. So that's nice and easy, isn't it? So think about that one. Just think about what the background looks like, because we should be doing that anyway, and move your subject further away, and then it won't be in focus. Now, the next thing we can do is we can change the focal length of our lens. So we can zoom in, we can zoom out, or we could physically fit a different lens to our camera. Longer lenses, so anything from sort of 50mm onwards, are more flattering to take pictures of people than wide-angle lenses. Okay? And the other effect that longer lenses also have is that they tend to compress the scene. So things that are further away seem closer together. I've mentioned it before, but imagine that type of scene where you're standing in the middle of a road with there's no traffic, and it's a straight road and it's disappearing into the distance. Along the side of the road are telegraph poles. If you use a wide angle lens, those telegraph poles will start to halve in height really quickly as they move away from you. So you get like these dynamic receding lines, these diagonals that are receding. However, if you were to take a telephoto, a zoom lens or a longer lens, and say zoom to 100, 130, all of a sudden, as you're looking through a viewfinder, those telegraph poles, those telephone poles that were originally sort of receding really quickly, all of a sudden they seem to be a similar height. Now, the telephone poles haven't moved. All that's really changing is your perspective. But that's very important, because what it's doing is it's bringing the background closer together. So if you're using if you're doing a headshot of somebody with a wide angle lens, so you've just got the head in the frame in the viewfinder, you put a telephoto zoom on, say 100mm or a telephoto lens, and then you have to walk further away, don't you, to get the same framing of their head in the viewfinder. But because of the way that you're now further away from the subject and further away from the background, the relative distance of you to the subject and compared to the other lens has changed, and the background, relatively speaking, is now closer to the subject than closer to you. What that means in reality is that as you're looking through a telephoto lens, the background appears closer to the subject. Because it's blurred anyway, the blurriness has been magnified, and so it appears that the background is more blurred. As I said before, in reality, if you did go to somewhere like dofmaster.com and enter the figures of your focal length, your f-stop and your distance to subject, you would find for the same framing of a subject at the same f-stop, it doesn't matter what lens you've got on, the depth of field is always the same. So if, for example, you've got a 50mm lens at f2.8, okay, with a headshot, and you were to check the depth of field, the depth of field would probably be, say they were, I don't know, 10 feet away. Say the depth of field is, I don't know, 7 inches or something like that. If you were then to double the focal length, so double it from 50 to 100, but get twice as far away, the depth of field would still be the same. However, it would look like the depth of field had got smaller because the background will be magnified, so the blurriness gets magnified. So that's a really important point. Again, don't stress about it, don't worry about it, just accept the fact that it works. So there we go. Now, the other thing that I didn't really mention in the video that I'll mention here as well is that the quality of those out of focus areas varies on the lens as well. So sometimes it's referred to as the bokeh or bokeh or whatever. That's the kind of phrase that describes what the out of focus areas look like, how pretty they are, if you like. And how it looks depends on the lens, really. It depends on the number of aperture blades in the lens, how many elements are in the lens, what the coatings are in the lens, all that sort of stuff. So what you find is some lenses might have a smoother bokeh than other lenses, but again, really, that depends on what your background is. If you've got a very busy background, you might find that the bokeh looks better if you move to a simple background, or vice versa. So what we've kind of done there is we've kind of approached the way of controlling your depth of field if you want a small depth of field look, you know, that classic, could be a person, could be a flower, anything you want to isolate by making the depth of field appear small. In other words, you want the background to be blurred. And as we said, the way that you do that is you choose a small f number on your lens, so f3.5, f2.8, f1.8, etc. You move your subject further away from the background. You yourself, you use a longer focal length, say anything from 50mm to 150mm for people, but have the same framing, and that will appear to make the depth of field smaller, and that will really help an awful lot. I mean, as a final aspect to that, what you tend to find is you'll find a sweet spot with your lenses that you'll use that you really like. On crop sensors, actually, one of the really nice cheap lenses you get is the 51-8. For Nikon, Canon, Sony, the 51-8 is always a cheap lens, and you can shoot it at 51-8, and because it's slightly telephoto on a crop sensor body, you know, entry level DSLR, it's quite nice. It's not an unflattering lens to use unless you're coming in really, really close. But you do have to be very careful because the depth of field gets very, very small. I like using my telephoto lens, my 55-250 zoom, around about 100mm, something like that. And I like the look of the photos that I get out of it that way. But play around and you'll see. Taking it to the other side of it, where you want everything in focus in a photo, there's a few things to think about. The first one is, if you're thinking what aperture should I be at in general as I'm running around and shooting stuff, you know, that would give me an acceptable depth of field, there's a couple of sayings that you can remember. F8 and B there is something that old photojournalists used to say. This was mainly due to the fact that they were shooting with cameras where they weren't looking through the lens, and so you would say F8 and B there, and F8 under most situations will give you an acceptable level of depth of field, so whatever you're pointing your camera at will probably be in focus. The other side of it is to remember this, is if you're using a tight aperture, say f16, f22, if you focus about a third of the way into the scene, everything else will be in focus, and lots of it will be in focus up towards the camera as well. You might find you have to use a tripod, because at f16 or f22 the shutter speed goes up considerably, and so there's a chance of getting camera shake or subject shake. And also at f22, your camera's dust on its sensor really does show up on areas of continuous tone, so skies and painted walls, that sort of thing. So watch out for that. Now, if you really want to get specific, there's lots of apps you can download for your smartphone. You can go over to dofmaster.com, and they've got an online one as well. And in that, you can put in different settings. So you could say, right, you know, I've got an 18mm lens on a Canon 350D. If I focus it at 10 feet f8, it will then tell you what's in focus. And it also gives you the hyperfocal distance. Now, the hyperfocal distance is the point at which everything else in the photo is in focus. And it can be quite close. Let's have a look. I'm on DofMaster now. Let's see. Computer's running a little bit slow at the moment. Let's see what we've got. What's coming up here? So, let's see. Here we go. Canon Digital Rebel 350D. So I'm running at 18mm, which is a wide angle. I'm doing an f16. f16 on the 18mm lens on my 350D. If you focus to, what does it say, something that's 10 feet away, everything that's from 2.6 feet in front of the camera to infinity will be in focus, will be acceptably sharp. Not bad. 2.6 feet away, that's not very far as well. That's at f16. So the hyperfocal difference for that lens at 18mm f16 is 7.4 feet. So that's not bad, is it? That's not bad at all. Sorry, the hyperfocal distance, sorry, is 3.56 feet, which is pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. So it shows you, at tighter apertures, your depth of field really does expand. Another one more thing, though. You would think that f22 is the sharpest aperture for your lens, wouldn't you? Because everything's in focus. It's not, actually. What you find is lenses are designed to be very, very sharp around the middle sort of apertures, sort of f8, f16, that sort of thing. f5.6 on the faster lenses. So watch out for that to do. And the beauty with digital is that you can bracket, can't you? So you can take one picture at f16, one at f22, one at f8, change your focus distance, that sort of thing. But hopefully, by talking about these things today, and maybe if you watch the video on YouTube as well, some of your questions about depth of field and controlling depth of field, why you would want to control depth of field and what you can do, maybe I've answered it. If there's any bits I've got wrong or missed out, by all means send me an email, scalespeeder@gmail.com. Remember, if you've got any questions or things you'd like me to address, send me an email as well. I'm always looking out for ideas for shows. Everybody, keep up the good work in the Flickr pool. Remember, it's free to join if you haven't done already. There's some great stuff going into the assignments for I think it runs to the end of the month, which is spring and high key. Thanks to everybody who's commented on the blog and on Flickr. Thanks to everybody who's done their iTunes reviews. Really appreciate that. Thanks to Everyday Jones for their intro and outro music. But most of all, thanks to you for downloading and listening to the podcast. My name's Rob from robnonphoto.com. And hopefully, pretty soon, I'll see you on Flickr.